Well, hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us tonight for another church history lecture. We have been going through, looking at some of the major developments within Puritan and Separatist England. We've looked under the rise of the Puritans under the reign of Elizabeth. We looked at some of the major issues that happened under James and Charles, his son Charles. We saw how all of that led ultimately to the English Civil War, which brought about the leadership of Oliver Cromwell and the establishment of England as a republic for the first and the last time. And tonight, we pick up with the death of Cromwell and the restoration of the English monarchy. The primary focus of our study, our lecture this evening, is going to be the rise of the nonconformist and the Revolutionary Act of Toleration in 1689. So that's going to be where we look at kind of our closing point tonight, is up to the Toleration Act of 1689. And then next week, we will pick up by looking north to Scotland, pretty much post the death of John Knox and the rise of the Scottish Covenanters. So let's go ahead and begin tonight with kind of the restoration of the English monarchy. After Cromwell's death in 1658, England plunged right into chaos almost immediately. And to the shock of many, a strong royalist group that was supportive of a monarchy was elected into the House of Commons. And they called for the restoration of a king. We need to have a king. The only thing that can maintain order within England is a monarch. And after many heated debates, the Presbyterians ultimately came to the side of the royalists and agreed to restore Charles, the son of Charles II, to the throne, with the agreement that religious liberty would be given to the Presbyterians. Now, Charles truly did desire religious tolerance. He actually really did want people to live in peace and to have, he really cared less about whether or not people were able to worship freely. And so he did have a strong desire to see that religious tolerance given and maintained. And so with the Declaration of Breda in 1660, he promised religious liberty to Presbyterians, but also gave amnesty to all of those who were alongside Cromwell and the Parliament and the New Model Army during the Civil War. And so this allowed amnesty to be given to those who had fought against the Royalist Army in the English Civil War. The newly appointed Convention Parliament then passed the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion, which granted the amnesty for all except those responsible for King Charles I's execution. So Parliament hears about this Breda Act and says, you know what, we will allow this amnesty with the exception of those who were directly responsible for the execution of Charles. And so Charles II returned home to a very popular reception, and this reestablishment of the Stuart monarchy is known as the Restoration. And after this, soon Charles decided, in order to try and show the people that he cared, that he wasn't going to be like James or others who would just totally reject or push aside Parliament, he immediately had elections held in May of 1661, and that produced what is known as the Cavalier Parliament, which was overwhelming with Anglican royalist representation, per se. And it had almost zero Presbyterian representation. And so you could see now you had a strong high church king and a very high church Anglican royal establishment there in Parliament as well. So Charles appointed as the head of his new administration a man by the name of Edward Hyde, who was the Earl of Clarendon. And under his guidance, the Cavalier Parliament proceeded to enact a new religious settlement for the country. The fierce Episcopalian nature of the settlement against the non-Episcopalians, the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians and whatnot, was a product of Parliament more than a product of the king. Remember, the Parliament at this point was far more religiously devoted than the king was. The king, like I said, he had wanted to maintain religious toleration, but Parliament did not. They wanted to see the rise and the increase of the high church Anglican movement once again. Charles was prepared to be tolerant, but the Anglican establishment was not going to have any of it. The Presbyterians, the Independents, and the Baptists had humiliated the Royalists on the battlefield, killed their king, and outlawed their worship. And now they were in the position of power, and they were going to make sure that those rebels felt that sense of power. The country soon took a very strong anti-Puritan turn. And the Puritanism of the Civil War was now nothing more than something to be ridiculed and mocked. Puritanism was simply given a kind of a humiliating term to others. It was something to be ridiculed and mocked by. It was no longer a sense of a strong or mighty title. It was something to be mocked and scorned with. The Church of England was soon reestablished shortly after by the Cavalier Parliament, and with it, the high church ideals that had been established under Charles I. The Act of Uniformity was drawn up in May of 1662 and required all parish clergy to renounce all of the confessions and covenants that they had committed to during the time under Cromwell, and to submit unconditionally to the doctrine and worship of the restored Anglican Church. During this period, over 1,000 clergy left the established church because of this act. But this was simply the case of a steady leak becoming a geyser. Prior to this specific act of uniformity, almost 1,000 other parish leaders and clergies had left slowly but surely as they saw the growing tide turning more and more towards a high Anglican establishment. During the years of 1660 to 1662, 1/5, 20% of all Anglican ministers left the Church of England. So you can see that this is a huge impact that's happening there. But for the Anglican establishment, this was in many ways a purifying thing. So they saw this as a good thing that was happening. Many attempts were made at reconciliation, including the Savoy Conference in 1661, where 12 Anglicans and 12 Presbyterians met to try and find a settlement, and few of the Presbyterians decided that they were not going to conform, that there was just no way that they were going to be able to come to agreement. And some of these men that refused to conform with the Anglicans included Richard Baxter, Edmund Calamy, and Thomas Manton, who were also expelled from England a year later in 1662. Now, not all mighty Calvinistic and Reformed thinkers left the established church. Even though the high church was really taking, once again, a strong Arminian stance, there were many Calvinist Anglicans that decided to stay in and to conform to the Act of Uniformity. These men were like Edward Reynolds, Robert Cross, John Wallace, and perhaps the most well-known, a man by the name of William Gurnall, who wrote a very famous work in practical divinity known as The Christian in Complete Armor. Parliament was soon enacting acts that would not only enact repressive measures on non-conforming Presbyterians, but also the Independents and the Baptists as well. These laws were known as the Clarendon Code and included the Corporation Act of 1661, which basically made the law that all who held public office had to conform to the established Anglican Church within 1 year of holding office. The Conventicle Act, which made all non-Anglican worship meetings illegal. And even this really interesting act known as the 5 Mile Act, which prohibited non-Anglican ministers from living or even temporarily lodging within 5 miles of any city or corporate town or any town where they had functioned as a minister or had given a lecture in the past. So you can't live within 5 miles of anywhere that you once served as a minister or lectured if you are a nonconformist. The penalty for breaking these laws were severe. Crippling fines, imprisonment, and even more interesting, being shipped out for slave labor to the Americans or Caribbean plantation for 7 years. It's important to realize that many of the first colonial slaves were religious slaves. They were Protestant slaves, Catholic slaves, nonconformist slaves, you name it, but they were slaves of a religious nature. And they would be sold over to slavery, and they would be kept in slavery for 7 years. And they got that idea of 7 years from the Old Testament system of slavery, which every 7 years slaves would be freed and given their freedom to live as their own master, per se. And so that is a fascinating thing, because oftentimes when we hear this concept of colonial slavery as simply that which was racist or racially motivated, that's just anachronistic. What's interesting is most of the racial concept of slavery did not become a thing until after the Revolutionary War. Because what happened is during the Revolutionary War, this idea became of, if humans are created beings and they have inalienable rights that include freedom, then how can we keep people enslaved when we just fought for freedom? And in order to justify that, as the utilitarian argument for slavery was being ripped out from under them, they needed new arguments which would allow them to justify slavery. And that is where ideas like three-fifths of a person came in, undermining the personhood of these African-American slaves. And this is when it went from being primarily a practical and utilitarian practice, which was slavery at that time, to now being one that was more racially motivated. And so that is a really important distinction to understand when we think of colonial slavery, that many of the early slaves were simply religious motivated. They were prisoners that would go and serve their term there. And it wasn't until later on when the utilitarian arguments and practical arguments of slavery were being stripped and removed away that they needed to create an ideological and racially motivated basis for slavery that was deeply, deeply wicked and evil. Nevertheless, this was a fascinating situation that was occurring there in England. Because for the first time, you had Protestant persecution in a Protestant state. But such persecution would only fuel the movement of what all these other persecuted groups who would come together to take a name. And that name of those who would not stand for this kind of persecution, who would not allow the established church to dictate them and to continue persecuting them. These groups that came together to go against the act of uniformity took the name the Nonconformist. For the next 25 years, these nonconformists or dissenters would face a long, dark night of persecution. For nearly a quarter century, these nonconformists were punished and had to go through horrific measures in order to practice worship, doing it often in secret and things like that. All prospect for reforming the Church of England any further than it was and receiving religious liberty for these nonconformists seemed to be hopelessly gone. And those who had been heroes in the Civil War now found themselves under immense persecution. One of the first response by many of these groups was violent rebellion. One example of this was the Fifth Monarchist, who rose up in a violent rebellion, and most of them were immediately killed or executed later on. It was not a successful rebellion whatsoever. And this was really fairly consistent throughout the history of those 25 years of nonconformity. Anytime nonconformist violent rebellions rose up, they were usually squashed, and the punishment inflicted was very, very severe. Many other plots of violent overthrows were made and ultimately squashed. Some nonconformists decided to take a more peaceful approach and found ways around the loopholes in the Clarendon Code. For instance, preachers like Adam Martindale would preach the same sermon throughout multiple times throughout the week to different portions of his congregation who would come to his home and meet there. And he did this in order to never violate the number, which was you can never have more than five visitors in your home at a time that weren't your family members. And so that was part of the conventicle act. And so what he would do is he would just bring five members at a time throughout the week and just preach them the message. And so he found a loophole in order to continue to meet that wasn't breaking the law. Others decided just to disobey, but they disobeyed with the use of cover. They met in secret, at night, in forest, and in caves. And others met in basements with elaborate escape routes dug and carved into them. Under the code, but under the Clarendon Code, between 5 and 8,000 nonconformists died in prison. So for that 25-year period, about 5 to 8,000 nonconformists would find themselves dying in prison. However, this did not sway the nonconformist one bit. Led by men like Richard Baxter, John Flavel, and John Owen, the Presbyterians and the Independents united and sought to undermine these acts with their writings. Some of the greatest writings of these men, like Baxter, Flavel, and Owen, which you better go and read all of those guys, all of those writings usually came out of this period. Others in these two camps that promoted nonconformity were men like Thomas Cole, Isaac Chauncey, and Richard Davis. Baptists, as well, were vital in writing treaties, but in also providing writing for further reform. The Baptists were continually calling for further reform and church development, including the utilization of hymn singing. It was during this period that the Baptists drafted their modified form of the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Savoy Declaration of Faith in what is known as the Second London Baptist Confession. That was written in 1677, ultimately published and made kind of the ultimate seal there. They voted it through, basically, in 1689 after the Toleration Act. One of the most important of these Baptists was Benjamin Keach, who was a pastor of the particular Baptist church at Horsley Down in Southwark. His Keach's Catechism was extremely influential, even though it is most likely not written by Keach, but rather written by a man by the name of William Collins. Keach is probably most notable, however, for his argument for the use of hymn singing in corporate worship. Remember, up to this point, there was no hymn singing in the predominant view of Baptist and in really most separatist congregations. There was no singing. And Keach's church was the first congregation there in England that was utilizing hymn singing. So they weren't just singing the Psalms, the Psalter, or things like that. They were actually singing man-written hymns that came from Scripture. Most of those hymns being written by Keach himself. And Keach, ultimately, though, this was a big controversy, it was him who would ultimately win the day, as congregational corporate singing would really become the predominant practice in worship into the 18th century and on. Another important Calvinistic Baptist during this time was a man by the name of John Bunyan. In 1655, Bunyan began preaching and was a captivating speaker. John Owen said of Bunyan, quote, "Could I possess that thinker's ability for preaching, I would gladly relinquish all my learning." Now that's a high statement coming from a man of immense learning like John Owen. However, Bunyan in 1660 was arrested for unlawful preaching and for the next 12 years spent most of his life in prison for the act. However, it was during that time in prison that he wrote his autobiography, Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, which is one of the most beautiful biographies that I've ever read, probably second to Augustine's Confession. So those two books, Augustine's Confessions and Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, are two spiritual autobiographies of great church thinkers that I just highly recommend reading sometimes. Just really powerful stuff. However, this work, even though it was one of his greatest writings, would not be the most important writing of Bunyan's career. In 1678, he published a book that would forever impact the spiritual and literature world. That book is known as Pilgrim's Progress. It was immediately a bestseller. Within 10 years, it had 11 authorized editions printed and was translated into four different languages. That's within a decade period. And so was a huge bestseller, and we can only imagine the numbers since as to how many people have read and been captivated by Pilgrim's Progress, an amazing book, a great spiritual allegory of Christianity. And so it's just a great book, and I highly recommend another pickup there to read sometime. And all of this, as these nonconformists are continuing to rise up and continuing to just be a thorn in the side of the Anglican Church and the king and the monarchy, ultimately, these nonconformists would eventually have their day. And one of the things that started to bring this closer and closer to being a reality for the nonconformists was the exclusion crisis. A second civil war seemed to begin looming on the horizon when a constitutional crisis occurred between the King Charles and the Parliament. Charles became close allies with the French King Louis XIV, who was a Roman Catholic king. And Charles secretly agreed with financial support from France that he would convert on his deathbed to Roman Catholicism. So France started pumping money to Charles secretly, and they did this on the basis that Charles would convert to Roman Catholicism on his deathbed. Immediately, Charles began putting forth pro-Catholic policies there in England. This, however, worked to the advantage to the nonconformists, shockingly, because this caused Charles to begin supporting religious toleration for all Christian-based religious groups in England in order to allow Catholics to freely worship. So he created this kind of concept of religious tolerance so that the Catholics could worship, but the nonconformists also benefited from this act of religious toleration. Charles put forth his Declaration of the Indulgence Act in 1672, which gave nonconformists and Catholics the ability to worship publicly while Catholics had to remain worshiping in private. This indulgence only lasted for a year before Charles was forced to cancel it, because Parliament argued that this was unconstitutional. This was unconstitutional for the king to make this kind of executive act unilaterally with no parliamentary procedures. And so in order to win back Parliament's favor, he pulled back all of his acts that he put forth that gave this religious toleration, and then he established the Test Act in 1673. Now, the Test Act required all who held any position of public responsibility to swear an oath denying transubstantiation, so that's denying Catholicism, and to partake of Holy Communion in the Anglican manner. And that basically pushed aside all the nonconformists. So it rejected Catholicism and it rejected nonconformity. It, the only way to therefore hold public office was to be within the established Anglican Church and to be an active member therein. Now, Charles had no legitimate sons. He had quite a few illegitimate sons, one of which we'll see just down the road. But nevertheless, if he died, his Catholic brother James would inherit the throne. And you can imagine the despair that this was causing. Why? Because everybody there is still very aware of what happened under the Catholic Queen Mary. And so they are very, very fearful that that is what's going to happen again. And so Parliament was very determined to exclude James from the throne by passing a special parliamentary act to that effect. And that is what is known as the Exclusion Act, right? They wanted to exclude James from being able to enter and to take the throne on the death of Charles. Now, this is what brought about the exclusion crisis, because Charles wanted James to be king in order to provide his French financial supporters the evidence that he truly was going to be converted to Catholicism and was leaning toward them. And so this was kind of his way to show France, yeah, I'm still bought in, so please keep sending me money. And so I want James to be king. Now, the pro-exclusion party in Parliament that wanted to make sure that there was no way that James could take the throne, they took the party name known as the Whigs, which probably came from a group known as the Whigamores in Scotland, who were raiders and individuals who rejected kingship of Charles. They wanted to throw off the yoke of Charles. And so that was kind of the idea behind these Whigs. They were kind of an anti-monarchy group. They wanted to push off some of the monarchical power that had been achieved through Charles, and really wanted to prevent a Catholic king from taking the monarchy. These Whigs not only opposed Roman Catholicism, but they opposed any unchecked kingly authority, but also championed the rights of the nonconformist for freedom to worship. Now, just a little aside for some American history here. There would also be an American party known as the Whig Party, which was formed by Henry Clay as a party to run against Andrew Jackson. And the reason that he took the name the Whig Party was because at that time everybody was calling Jackson King Andrew, right? Because he had this very high government view. The government was going to take control. The government was going to have its hand in everything. And so they began to call him King Andrew. And so Henry Clay established the Whig Party because it was kind of a party that opposed unchecked kingly authority. And ultimately that Whig Party, the abolitionist anti-slavery group of that party would break away and become what is known as the Republican Party, with its first presidential candidate, Abraham Lincoln. So just a really kind of neat U.S. history aside for those as well. I'll give you a little bit of both in this church history lecture. Now, the opponents of this exclusion bill and the Whigs were given the nickname Tories. So now you have two parties being formed, the Whigs, who are kind of anti-absolute monarchical authority, and the Tories, who are all for the monarchical authority. These were given the name Tory because it came from the Irish name for outlaw, and it was likely because of the link between Irish Catholicism and James's Catholicism. The Tories were supporting James's ascension to the throne upon the death of Charles, and so the Whigs began to call them Tories, which were rebels and outlaws in Ireland who were the Irish Catholic outlaws. And so that's the way those two names came to bring about. Now, these two parties went back and forth, and ultimately the majority Tory party won out, especially with the Whigs' alliance with the nonconformists. Because the Whigs decided to be friendly with nonconformists, the Tories ultimately won the day, and they were by far the majority party during this time. And because of the fact that the nonconformists were more on the side of the Whigs, this actually brought more persecution to the nonconformists. And so the nonconformists really paid for the fact that the Whigs were supporting them in their belief for religious toleration. Charles ultimately died in February of 1865 and was received into the Roman Catholic Church on his deathbed. And his Catholic brother James was then placed on the throne of England as King James II. When King James II was crowned to the English throne, he followed all of the normal Anglican ceremonies, and he made promises to them there. A lot of people were very, very leery of what would happen. He made promises that he would make no attempts to re-Catholicize England. In order to prove this, James put forth another general election for Parliament, showing that he did care for the will of the people. However, many Puritans did not believe James' moderate stance, and a violent rebellion soon broke out, led by James Scott, the Duke of Monmouth. Now, Scott was one of those illegitimate sons of Charles II, and most of his rebellion was an amassing of mostly lower class nonconformists. Many of the upper class nonconformists chose not to fight and to stay on the sideline. Probably because of this, ultimately, the Monmouth Rebellion was crushed and Scott was executed. During this time, 800 to 900 of the participants of the Monmouth Rebellion were shipped off to slave pen plantations into the colonies, while those who were executed had their bodies put out on display to serve as a lesson for anyone else who thought to rise up in rebellion. After the Edict of Nantes was revoked by the King of France, many French Huguenots, to escape persecution, flooded into England, and James absolutely despised this. Unfortunately, there was nothing he could do because he knew that if he kicked them out, this would cause a popular uprising for many who were who in many ways cared and desired to support the French Huguenots. So James begins to kind of underneath the surface, begins to gather, calls Parliament and says, hey, I need you to give me resources in order to gather a very large royal army because I'm afraid of what these Huguenots are going to do to perhaps espouse some sense of revolution amongst these individuals, because I'm a Catholic king, they're escaping Catholic persecution, are they going to arouse the populace and ultimately have them revolt against me? So he wants to strengthen and enlarge the royal army. And in order, and he does this by appointing Catholic officers, because he says those are the only ones I can truly trust. But the idea of appointing Catholic officers alone was just too much for Parliament to grant. And so because of that, James decides, well, I'm just going to dissolve Parliament and take matters into my own hands. So by 1686, James was now actively promoting Catholicism in England and began to put Catholic leaders in some of the highest positions in the land and suspending any laws that had been suppressive to Catholics before. And because of all of this, soon the Tories and Whigs actually joined together against James. And they had the population behind them. So now you have totally bipartisan support of what used to be a fierce rivalry in order to oppose James. And so James decides, man, this isn't good. I'm having literally everybody turn against me now. And so James decides, what I'm going to do then to try to counter this is he issues a declaration of indulgence which allowed for the freedom religion for all nonconformists. And he did this hoping that it would gain popular support. He gives them total freedom to worship, absolute freedom to worship how they want. And he thinks this will keep the population, the populace, the people off my back. How can they revolt against me if I'm going to give them the freedom of religion that their Anglican establishment would never do so? And though many took advantage of this freedom of religion, it still did not alleviate their suspicions against the king. The great particular Baptist leader, William Kiffin, advised nonconformist churches to take pragmatic advantages of the freedoms, but to offer no thanks at all to James, because what he was doing was ultimately unconstitutional. In one of the most incredible paradoxes of history, most nonconformists decided to flock to the support of the Anglicans, their former persecutors, who were having them sold into slavery, burnt at the stake, locked in prison to die. They sided with them against the Catholic King James, who had granted them freedom to worship. And this just goes to show you the level of detestation that the nonconformists and the Protestants had against Rome. This was a united Protestant front against Rome. Even if it meant being persecuted again, it was better than siding with someone who supports Rome. That was really the idea behind the nonconformist. On June 30, 1686, seven opposition leaders, wrote a letter to William of Orange, the highest federal official of the Dutch Republic. And they wrote to him to bring his Dutch armies to land in England and to liberate the Protestant people from the Catholic suppression and the high absolute monarchical leadership of James II. Now, what's fascinating is William of Orange was married to James' eldest daughter, who was a Protestant, Mary. And James soon had a son, like he had very recently had a son, who was now the heir to the throne. And so the letter was written to William of Orange with much urgency, basically saying, hey, he has an heir now to the throne. We need you to come and liberate us, and we need you to come and liberate us now. Now, William honestly cared very little for English religious liberty. He could honestly care less about it. But he did have a goal to destroy all the ambitions of Catholic France to reestablish a Catholic Europe. And that was really the idea of Louis XIV. He wanted to bring all of Europe once again under Catholicism, establish the holy kind of Catholic empire where he would now serve as the emperor. That was really his main goal. And William wanted to do anything to squash those ambitions. So William decided to go and gain the support of the Dutch ruling class, which he did, and he went and got the alliance of German allies under Prince Frederick there in Germany. And when a favorable wind came on November 1st of that year of 1686, William set sail to England with 600 ships carrying 15,000 troops. And he landed at Torbay in Devon on November 15th. There, the army waited, and William published a manifesto where basically he declared, "I have not come in conquest. I did not come to take over England. I did not come to rule England per se. I did not come to do any of that. I have come at the request of English religious and political leaders to help support their cause and their cause alone, and to denounce King James for his unconstitutional acts." With this waiting giant army there in England, this called the royal army to begin to divide and turn against one another, and ultimately turn against James. And so King James had to flee, and he was caught by a Protestant mob, but William decided to have him escape to France. He was not going to make him a martyr. Rather, he was going to let him go and escape and just be out of the picture. Once James had left, the members of the House of Lords, together with the members of the House of Commons, entrusted William with its administration. He called them to a convention in 1689 to settle England's political and religious affairs. The English throne was declared vacant by this Act of Parliament, and the Whigs and the Tories soon argued over who would fill it. That bipartisan support was now gone, and they were back to arguing once again. The Whigs argued that William needs to be the king for good. He needs to be the king, and he will now reestablish the hereditary lineage of the monarchy. The Tories said, no, William can serve as a regent until James' son is of age, and then he can take the throne. And the reason why is because the Tories really believed in the hereditary nature of the monarchy. They believed that that was the way in which the divine right was passed down. And so if there was a hereditary line, that next in line had to fill the throne. And so that was their argument. William, however, was like, no way. I'm not serving as just some regent for a kid. And so the Tories ultimately caved in, with the exception of six individuals, known as the non-jurors. That is to say, they would not swear an oath to William. And so these were known as non-jurors. And one of those was a very famous leader known as Thomas Ken. And you may say, well, I've never heard of that name. Well, maybe not. But Thomas Ken is the author of what we sing very often, known as the doxology. He is the author of the doxology. So ultimately, everybody else conformed. And on April 11, 1689, Bishop Compton of London crowned William and Mary as joint monarchs of England. The reason that Mary had to be considered a joint monarch was because she was the daughter of James. And so this was a little bit of a concession so that the Tories could still say there was a hereditary line into the monarchy. And so William and Mary became the rulers of England. And you've probably heard the College of William and Mary, but that is where that comes from. William of Orange and his wife Mary are now the king and queen of England. They were crowned on the condition that they would accept a Bill of Rights, which would extinguish any idea of absolute monarchical authority in England. This Bill of Rights was very important for another Bill of Rights, and that would be the Bill of Rights that would be added to the American Constitution, which gave the religious liberties and other liberties that many Americans enjoy through the Bill of Rights. And this is where that idea really came out of, with the Magna Carta, now the Bill of Rights, and into the American Bill of Rights. This event that came out of this Bill of Rights and the establishment of William and Mary is known as the Glorious Revolution. And the reason why it's called glorious is because it was bloodless. There was no blood shed by armies or anything like that to bring about this change and revolution. The religious settlement of this also was very, very important because it brought forth the Toleration Act of 1689, which gave freedom to worship to Presbyterians, Independents, that's Congregationalists, Baptists, and Quakers. However, it did not give any religious toleration to anti-Trinitarians. And so it wouldn't be until the 19th century that individuals, that groups like the Unitarians would be given freedom to worship and acts of toleration to worship within England. However, non-Anglicans could still not hold public office. This was a big issue. Or send their sons to Oxford or Cambridge. That was still only for the high church. And they had to pay tithes to the Anglican church. So even though they could worship within their own free congregations, they still had to pay tithes to the Anglican church. The Whigs, however, became a strong voice of support for the nonconformists and actually allowed some nonconformists to end up serving in a public office and others to get places of higher positions as well. And they also provided a lot of the safety that would not have came to the nonconformists had the Whigs not been there to support them. You may ask, what ever did happen to James? And James actually did attempt to try and take back England. Not shocking at all. When he went to France, there they basically gave him 6,000 troops, and he thought that he would go and invade Ireland, gain the support from all of the Irish peasants, who were almost overwhelmingly Catholic still, and used the peasant army plus the 6,000 army to crush the English nobles, the British nobles there in Ireland, and then ultimately ride into England and once again take that. However, that wasn't the case. William's forces crushed James once again there in Ireland, and this ultimately caused once again Ireland to be placed, the Irish Catholics to be placed under British rule, Protestant British rule, where the Irish Catholics were treated like second-class citizens. And that would pretty much remain the case until the revolution in Ireland in the early 20th century, with the rise of the IRA and the wars that took place there to gain Irish independence. And so for nearly almost three more centuries, almost, this kind of second-class citizenship was a reality for many Irish Catholics during this time. Well, that's where we're going to close tonight. We have pretty much covered all of the developments in Puritan England from under Elizabeth's reign all the way up to the Toleration Act, which has now given the nonconformists, the Puritans, and the Separatists the freedom to worship there in England. And we are now going to turn our attention north to Scotland. We're going to begin next week by looking at kind of the end of the life and death of John Knox and the rise of the Scottish Covenanters and some of the major developments that were happening there within Protestant Scotland. So that's what we'll pick up next week. So let's go ahead and pray. Father God, we just thank you for this time we have to come together and study. We thank you for the ability to look at history and learn from history. And God, we just ask that you would just continue to be with us, protect us, keep us safe throughout the week to come, and allow us to just continue to look to you to be light and salt to the world right now, God, in this dark time and of pestilence and sickness. We just ask that we would continue to be absolutely bold in proclaiming the gospel, the need for repentance, and the truth of salvation alone in Christ Jesus. So God, please just once again, just I plead blessing over everyone's family. Please keep them safe, look out for them, and just allow us to continue to be your lights to the world. So we thank you, and we praise you, and we say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.